Москве напали на оппозиционного политика Алексея Навального.
Ему в лицо какой-то чучундрик плеснул меня в зеленку. Я даже не понял, что происходит.
Плеснули зеленкой, размешанной еще с чем-то.
Каждый день мы узнаем о каких-то очередных то обысках, то задержаниях.
Vigilante chemical attacks against Kremlin critics. Teachers berating and even threatening students for supporting the opposition. Online video smear campaigns against opposition leaders. And Vladimir Putin's regime is shocked, shocked, and has absolutely nothing to do with any of it. Nod, nod, wink, wink. Don't look now, but the Kremlin's campaign against the opposition appears to have gone hybrid. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark. I hope you keep us in the enlightenment zone.
I'll do my best.
You always do. And joining us, also joining us on the Skype line from Moscow is journalist and playwright Natalia Antonova, an editor at Open Democracy Russia. Welcome back, Natalia. Always great to have you on.
Likewise. It's good to talk to you guys. Good. I feel smarter already.
we're in the enlightenment zone. So as long as Mark is with us, we're totally in the enlightenment zone. So Alexei Navalny has been attacked with the green antiseptic Zelyonka twice in the past couple months. An online video has alleged that the anti-corruption crusader and opposition leader has fascist leanings. Teachers and university professors have been berating and warning their students not to support Navalny or the opposition. In fact, just this week, the vice principal of a high school in Vladimir Oblast told students that campaigning for Navalny is extremist activity and they could be seized from their homes and placed in orphanages, even if they visit his campaign offices. What all these things have in common is that the Kremlin claims to have nothing to do with any of them. But everybody at the same time knows the Kremlin approves, or seems to approve, of all of them. Mark, I know you think we overuse the hybrid label, but let me throw this one out. Throw out a little factoid for you. Alexander Petrunko, the man identified by internet sleuths as being involved in the Zelyonka attack on Navalny, was also involved in a 2014 attempt to seize control of the regional administration building in Kharkiv during Russia's hybrid war in Ukraine. Hybrid war meet hybrid repression. What do you think?
My big thing about the use of the word hybrid is in some way everything in Russia is hybrid, and therefore in some ways nothing is hybrid. So I mean, the same way as I don't think we should be using it for what happened in Ukraine.
Do you see a coordinated campaign here?
Well, I think ad-hocism? Multiple things again, and I think this is precisely the problem. On the one hand, we have things that are clearly organized by the state specifically. I mean, take that Navalny the Nazi video,
which they denied having any involvement.
Of course, they did. No one's going to say, excuse me, we're just popping out for a bit of repression. We'll be back in a moment. You know, that's not. But you know, we know that there are state resources that are thrown into that specifically and directly.
It had all the hallmarks.
Absolutely.
Of the production.
Then there are things that a state encouraged. I mean, and it might well be, you know, I don't know, but it might well be precisely that these Zelyonka attacks are actually sort of encouraged by the state, but not specifically done by state assets. It's more just simply we would like you to go off and do bad stuff to these people. And what you do is entirely up to you, and it's nothing to do with us.
The nationalist group SERB appears to be behind these.
Precisely. But again, what we don't know is if it's just a generic, now's the time to show your teeth, or is it a specific, we want you to do this, and so forth. But there's a third element, which is in some ways the most problematic, is the Kremlin has created this extraordinarily permissive environment for certain kind of actions. And this is just, I mean, for example, you know, if we go back to the Nemtsov shooting, again, my view was never that this was something that was mandated in the Kremlin. In many ways, it was embarrassed. But the point is that it had created an environment in which someone like Kadyrov could feel, well, I don't like this guy, and I'm sure the Kremlin would like it, so I'll have him wiped out. So the problem is actually that you almost create this entrepreneurial mobilization regime in which actually you're encouraging people to get to sort of second guess what they think the Kremlin wants to do to anyone who's opposing it and go out and do it.
Well, there are risks involved in this, and I saw two pieces in the past week, an editorial and from two very different directions, incidentally, an editorial in Vedomosti, hardly a friend of the Kremlin, claiming that this is dangerous for the Kremlin because they're losing control of their monopoly on violence. And just a couple days ago, Mikhail Rostovsky had a piece in Moskovsky Komsomolets, pro-Kremlin commentator. Rostovsky had a piece in Moskovsky Komsomolets saying the Kremlin is losing its moral high ground by allowing this to happen. Those are his words, not mine. By allowing these things to happen, it appearing to be fighting dirty and creating an anything-goes environment. Is this a dangerous...
I think it is. I mean, not because I necessarily feel that it's about losing the monopoly of violence. I mean, on one level, you could say, just ask Nemtsov, who has the monopoly of violence. But another one, you know, the state still can crack down. No, exactly. I'm saying, you know, so on one level, you could say it's already lost it.
Okay.
But on another level, look, I mean, you know, the state resources are such that if you're anyone short of Kadyrov, then basically the state can crack down on you. But I think it's precisely, it is actually the second point that... So much of the Putin regime's legitimacy, and certainly when it seeks to still sort of play that desperate, well, at least it's not the 1990s card, is about this is the guy who brought order and stability to the streets. And the point at which you start encouraging vigilantes and all kinds of sort of freaks and weirdos to actually just go out and visit misery on people. On the one hand, sure, it visits misery on people you want to have a miserable life. But at the same time, again, it makes it look as if either... you are just simply in charge of a cabal of thugs, or that you don't control it. We're not yet at the point of having a kind of dizzy with success moment. But nonetheless, I think there is a point where if this continues and expands, then it will become problematic.
I mean, there's been some interesting elements to the Kremlin's response. If you look today, for example, it's been reported that an actual criminal case is being opened in the latest Zelyonka attack on Navalny. It took a while, but apparently it's been open. What that means, I don't know yet. The high school and teachers and principals that have been berating students and I'm amazed they continue to let these kids videotape these things and put them online, but they do.
But I think it's very surreptitious. They try to hide the phone.
Yeah, they'd take more measures to stop that because it is embarrassing. But they have been reprimanded. Now again, is that a kind of nod wink wink reprimand or is it a real reprimand? I don't know.
I mean, I'll be honest. I would suspect that it's the latter. Not because I think that the Kremlin has suddenly discovered its moral compass, but precisely because this is stupid. I mean, there is repression, there is smart repression, and there is dumb repression.
But the fact that it's happening in so many different places, so many times, suggests some kind of coordination, no?
I'm not convinced. I'd be interested to know what
Natalia feels,
because, I mean, I think my view is, no, what happens is everyone is desperate to try and catch the vibe. Everyone wants to try and guess, in a way, what the Kremlin really wants, and particularly, you know, state functionaries in various levels. And I think, therefore, you know, people are making their own assumptions about what's what, or else they're worried that if their kids suddenly, I don't know, appear in video bearing pro-Navalny posters or whatever, someone will come back to them and said, wow, you've been doing a really bad job in the classroom. In some ways, I mean, again, yeah. I don't think we should feel sorry for them. But in some ways, they're stuck between wanting to try and predict what the Kremlin is going to do and at the same time knowing that they can't predict what the outcomes might be. Mm.
Natalia, Open Democracy has been doing some great work on both the protests and the Kremlin's response to them. What's your take on all this?
Well, I think, I mean, I like the Open Democracy approach to this, which tries to focus not so much on, you know, the big names, but tries to kind of go after the stories of ordinary people involved in these protests. And I mean, I think that's really important because, you know, whether we like it or not, whether, you know, we as experts want to admit it or not, it's going to be these ordinary people that will shape Russia's destiny going forward. I mean, obviously, I don't think that Putin is getting toppled anytime soon, for example. But I think what's happening now is that, people like Navalny and people who are in tune in general with, the ills of Russian society, they're playing the long game. The economic situation has worsened. Standards of living are being eroded for the average Russian. And this, as Mark was saying, you know, Putin really sold himself on this platform of A, stability, you know, people are not going to get shot in the streets anymore, and B, better living standards, you know, living with dignity, having a better salary, and so on and so forth. Just, you know, after all the wounds of the 90s, you know, he really played that card, and he was winning for a while. And what we're seeing now, and I think
This is true of the Kremlin. This is true of ordinary people. We're seeing that, you know, those arguments and that strategy have exhausted themselves. Hmm. And it's happening very slowly. It's not something I think that's going to, you know, like, I really hate all the sensationalist articles about this, about how, yeah, you know, like the ruble has fallen and Putin's out tomorrow. That's not necessarily happening. But what we are seeing is a change. And I think that, you know, I think that someone like Navalny, you know, like him or hate him, I think he understands that change very well. And I think he can really, you know, like there's a reason why thousands of people came out, you know, in support of his agenda. And, you know, and most of these protests that were led by Navalny recently, they were not sanctioned. And people have been really scared to stage any unsanctioned protests because we've seen all the show trials of previous protesters. We've seen Ildar Daydin get tortured in a penal colony for peaceful protest. And people are scared, but you know, the fear is beginning to get outweighed by the fact that, you know, nobody knows where this ship is going anymore, but it's certainly not sailing over smooth waters.
Yeah, no, I've called it a tortoise revolution. Is this kind of slow moving process that bit by bit the legitimacy of this regime kind of gets chipped away at. And we're gonna talk more about the protests in the second half, but Natalia, I want to get your opinion of something else, is the Kremlin's response as well. Do you sense any desperation on their hands? Because let me throw a few things together related to the protests. I mean, you said one of them, Russians are not afraid to attend unsanctioned protests. It's not just that Navalny put so many people on the streets. I was surprised there were fewer than Navalny, but how many people Khodorkovsky was able to put on the street in the Udolos protest? That was pretty impressive for Khodorkovsky. For Khodorkovsky.
I didn't think it was that impressive, actually. I thought it was very kind of insignificant compared to the Navalny factor.
Can I
actually just jump in and have a small rant about Khodorkovsky? I'll try and keep it away. I mean, I was really quite bothered by these. I mean, because they were, I felt, pretty unimpressive protests. Secondly, one of the reasons why Navalny has been so successful is precisely that he has focused his fire on Medvedev and on corruption, on things that matter to people and things that people feel are achievable. You know, it's not as though I think anyone can honestly believe that have enough names on a petition saying, please don't stand in 2018, and Putin will say, fair enough, it's a fair cop, I'll go and enjoy myself elsewhere. No, I mean, the point is, Khodorkovsky's protests were about grand systemic change. And frankly, there's no real prospect of that happening. But the danger is that actually we start getting mixed messages. We now have, in effect, two people trying to mobilize protests against the regime in different directions.
We have more than two, but we'll get to that.
But in big picture sort of political terms, and one of whom is still an extraordinarily tainted brand.
I want to kind of push back on that a little bit and say, yes, he is an extraordinarily tainted brand, and the fact that he could put any people on the streets at all in an unsanctioned protest is itself impressive. I don't think what was important so much was what they were focusing on. I think the fact that people were willing to come to the streets for an unsanctioned protest organized by Mikhail Khodorkovsky.
Well, okay, but that's, I mean, but think about this.
Was impressive.
One of the reasons why Bolotnaya failed was precisely because of division. Was precisely you actually have people sort of, you know, heading in different directions.
Are you so sure Navalny and
Khodorkovsky
are operating at cross purposes? I'm not.
Honestly, I'd imagine so, because look, I cannot imagine two more closely surveilled individuals at this stage than Khodorkovsky and Navalny. I think any even hint of cooperation and partnership is precisely something that the regime will splash on a massive level. I mean, to be perfectly honest, and I hope no one from the regime is listening, I mean, if I was sitting in the Kremlin, I would be busy manufacturing the evidence to prove that, in fact, Navalny
there you go
was,
again.
Was,
giving
was,
them
was
ideas,
funded.
Mark.
Well, this is it, but, you know, you heard it here first.
But I wanted to...
But the point is that at the moment, the risk is precisely you fragment. Navalny sort of really needs momentum. He did amazingly in terms of how many he got out before. Now he's going to hold these June 12th protests on Russia Day. He needs to be able to demonstrate, and this is what actually empowers people to feel they can come out, is when you think there's lots of numbers around you. You think you're part of something bigger. You have momentum. My worry is that this actually might get in the way of him building that momentum.
See, I'm kind of stepping back and broadening the aperture and looking at this thing and saying, wow, Russians aren't afraid to go in the streets. Okay, for Navalny, charismatic figure, I could see that happening. But Khodorkovsky, even in the hundreds, I was impressed, quite frankly. But that's just one of the points I wanted to throw out here. The Russians aren't afraid to attend unsanctioned protests, and I think the Khodorkovsky thing just illustrates and buttresses that fact. The blacklisting of Open Russia, why do they bother doing that? And then a Levada poll comes out today, this week, showing that just 48% are prepared to vote for Putin for re-election, which is remarkably, remarkably low.
That is very low.
Yeah. I think it's the lowest number I've seen since the Crimea annexation, which suggests the Crimea rush, the Crimea bubble, the whatever, the high the Russians have gotten from that drug has worn off and the hangover's setting in. Now, you put all these things together and you sense maybe there's a little desperation in the Kremlin, no?
Well, I don't know about desperation because obviously they have a huge administrative resource at their beck and call. And what they're going to start doing now, and I think they have, you know, noticed this poll, they're going to start, you know, reaching everyone they can, reaching all the regional, you know, party heads and all the teachers and all the usual people that they inevitably engage when you have elections and polls and stuff like that. And they're going to, you know, try to bolster their numbers that way. And it's kind of this very old, very sort of neo-Soviet system of, you know, trying to influence elections and opinion polls. But, you know, it does tend to work, especially like outside of big cities where people are, as Mark was pointing out, like, for example, those teachers that you see berating their students, like, what are they really afraid of? They're afraid of somebody else spotting their students at a demonstration, and then the teacher is stuck with the blame. You know what I mean? So they have this idea that, like, if you work for the government, if you're in any way dependent on the state budget, then you're like государевые люди, you belong to the state in a way, and you owe your allegiance, and it doesn't matter what you think personally about politics or whatever, but you owe your allegiance, and you have to go out and you have to bolster the vote, and you have to bolster support for Putin. So I think that, I mean, they're obviously going to try doing that regardless of what is happening with the 2018 election, because those numbers are ridiculously low. I do agree.
That's not an approval figure. The approval figure is still in the 80s, but yeah, the would vote for him figure is in the 40s.
The approval figure is very, I think it's different from that. I mean, there's a reason why it's different, because I think that, you know, approval is kind of a passive thing. You know, you approve, but you're not really doing anything with your approval. You're just saying, I approve into the phone. But actually going in and, like, you know, checking off Putin on the ballot, that's something else. That's active. And, of course, I think, as a lot of people, a lot of, like, experts have been saying for several years now, the support for Putin and Russia has gotten to be very, very passive as opposed to active support. And those are just two different things. And, yeah, it's going to affect outcomes, it's going to affect polls, it's going to affect Russia leading up to this election. So, I mean, I don't know if desperation is the word that I would personally use, but I do think that they have reason to be worried, and I absolutely agree with you about Crimea. You know, that drug is definitely worn off. And it's even, I mean, I think it's worn off in Crimea itself. You know, there's ample evidence to suggest that it has.
Buyer's remorse, yeah. Right. Mark, what do you make of these low poll numbers, and what do you make of do you see desperation?
No, I think I'd agree with Natalia. Is that I think the Kremlin is well aware that it still has a lot of assets, you know, all the way from the National Guard through to juicy contracts being held over big sort of factories, sort of complexes, and such like. But I think it's this grudging realignment of expectations. You know, not so long ago, they were thinking of these elections as coronation.
Yes.
There was this notion of this 70-70, you know, 70% turnout, 70% vote for Putin, which would really be a very sort of solid endorsement and such like. Well, I think it's clear that those were long, long since buried. I mean, although there's still some talk about
That report came 70%. Out from a Kremlin think tank this week predicting 75%.
But that's of the vote. Now, I think the interesting thing is we're probably going to see them once again getting into the point where they try and ensure that actually the turnout is fairly mediocre, but at least that all of their people get whipped out to vote. But anyway, that's still a long way away. So, but I think what it is precisely this shift from a degree of triumphalism to a degree of survivalism. Just simply think that, you know, we've got these irritating elections. We have to go through this charade. Let's at least try and do so in a way that doesn't weaken us too much. Because obviously, you know, the more assets they throw in, then the more they get weakened. the more that they build up expectations which they then fail to meet, or they have to rig the elections to meet, the more they get weakened. So, I mean, I think this is just a sort of... This is, in a way, just part of just getting past it. There is the second and the wider issue, which is precisely what the mood in the country is. And again, I mean, I think this is absolutely... This has shown the limitations of any kind of imperial/nationalistic legitimating narrative.
But they're still going to change the election date to the 18th of March to coincide with the annexation of Crimea.
Squeeze what they can out, of course. But again, I mean, I think what is clear is that that's actually not a particularly great and lasting resource. But the second wider point is, I mean, look, is this just a blip? And I don't think it is, because this is not just something that one can actually ascribe. It's not actually about Medvedev, and sacking Medvedev will fix it. It's about corruption, and Medvedev is just the convenient poster child. It's not about just one particular, you know, set of bad economic results. It's about long-term economic decay, but also the way that not enough of that money has actually made its way to ordinary people, and too much has gone either into, you know, defense and security, or just simply into the pockets of Putin's cronies. It's about deep systemic
interrupt
things.
For a second, yeah. I'm so sorry, Mark, but it just occurred to me that even as living standards in Russia improved, the economic disparity, the social inequality skyrocketed. I mean, and that's what, you know, that's the problem is that, yeah, you're giving some people some crumbs sometime, and for a while they're happy with the crumbs. But Russia right now is basically the most unequal major economy in the world. And that's a national security risk, I think. I mean, if I was, like, once again, if I was advising the Kremlin for whatever reason, I would be telling them that. So, yeah, but please continue. Sorry for interrupting.
No, it's fine.
Absolutely right, because precisely, I mean, this is the point. You can get away with a lot so long as things are going up. You know, as long as everyone's quality of life is improving, if some people's quality of life is improving a hell of a lot, people will largely either not notice it so much or just put up with it. And really, that was the story of the 2000s. In the sense of, you know, there were clearly a lot of people who were benefiting dramatically, but so was everyone else to a degree. Now you actually have a situation in which actually ordinary Russians are paying precisely to maintain the privileged elite in their current position. You know, it's money being transferred to protect those who are under sanctions from any of their losses abroad, or precisely to build a bridge to Crimea, or do all these other kinds of things. It's at the expense of the overwhelming majority of Russians. You know, I think it's an important point to remember that the Russians are Putin's first victims.
Yeah, and we'll definitely get to this in the second part, where we talk about the truckers' protest and the Khrushchevki in Moscow and everything else. One thing I also wanted to throw out there, and Natalia, you kind of alluded to this with the Crimea drug wearing off. It's almost like we've gone back to the futures, like we've rewound the clock to where we were in 2011, 2012, 2013, when the Kremlin was back on its feet, or back on its heels, I guess I would want to say. It's almost like we've kind of erased these last
kind
couple of years,
but
or no.
The situation is more precarious. I mean, the ruble is, you know, we look at what happened to the ruble. It is really kind of crashed and burned in the last few years. And you're also just dealing with the fact that there are way more angry, desperate people nowadays. I mean, there are people in Russia, I feel like in 2011, 2012, a lot of the people who protested had a lot to lose. And what we're seeing now is that a lot of the people who are coming out to protest are, you know, they're really, I mean, they're coming out and saying this. They're saying, I don't have that much to lose anymore. And yeah, so I think it's in a way, yeah, we're seeing that same mood, but I feel like it's gotten more bitter and darker as the result of all the things that have happened in these last few years, including the undeclared war with Ukraine that a lot of people have a problem with and are scared by. You know, even people, I feel like a lot of people who are anti-Ukraine in Russia, for example, they're scared of the instability. Like, for example, now we're seeing the relationship between Minsk and Moscow deteriorate. And you have people who are very much anti-Ukraine and even pro-Putin in some ways, but they're also going, well, wait a minute, are we going to fight Belarus next? Like, what's going on? Is my son going to get drafted? You know, like that kind of instability, it always breeds more instability. Violence breeds more violence. So I feel like it's much darker now than it used to be.
So we could say 2011, 2012 was aspirational, and this is more desperate. Desperation, to use the term I applied to the word desperational, yeah.
Yeah, also, but I mean, I think firstly, certainly Navalny has learned many lessons from 2011, 2012. If one looks at his campaign, the way he's very much sort of moved to go beyond the Moscow set and such like. So, I mean, I think lessons learned there. But at the same time, in some ways, Putin is in a very different position. You know, this, the first round, the Bolotnaya round, was pre-Crimea, pre-sanctions, and sort of pre this sense of sort of, you know, a global confrontation. The economy, obviously, it's had its challenges, but hadn't been grinding down to the same extent. But perhaps more importantly, Putin was kind of fresh. I mean, okay, only kind of, but, you know, he'd had his time, you know, as prime minister, and there was a sense of him coming back. And in some ways, there was always also this element of Putin versus Medvedev. And clearly, sort of, Putin is much more serious a figure than Medvedev. Now, I mean, I was amazed, being in Moscow last month, how many people were already talking and thinking about a post-Putin Russia.
Yeah, you're seeing more of this in the media as
exactly,
well.
I mean, yeah. And not because they think that he's going to not win the election in 2018, but the very fact is almost like they themselves had this fin de siècle feel, that one did not get in 2011, 2012. Then there was a sense of a sort of a powerful and vigorous regime meeting a protest movement. Now, I think there's more of the sense of a protest movement meeting a regime that is actually uncomfortably aware of its own mortality.
So you're saying that Putin's a lame duck?
He's not. He's a long way from that. Maybe a sort of a lame double-headed eagle. But you know, he still has mighty talons and fangs.
All right. Any thoughts on this before we move on to the second part, Natalia? I'm anxious.
I really like the image of the lame double-headed eagle. That is an awesome image. Those are my thoughts.
Well, we'll leave that image hanging as we shift gears. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and change the vantage point from how the Kremlin's messing with the opposition to how the protesters are messing with the Kremlin. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio, keeping us in the Enlightenment zone, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow is journalist and playwright Natalia Antonova, editor of Open Democracy Russia. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Уличные протесты в России.
В Петербурге сегодня собрались более трех. В России прошла акция «Надоел» десятки людей.
В акции приняли участие десятки тысяч человек.
Антикоррупционная Москва столица
России. So we know Алексей Навальный can put people on the streets and... Yes, Mikhail Khodorkovsky can put people on the streets too. Long-haul truckers are continuing their protests against a new road tax that Bennett's longtime Putin crony Arkady Rotenberg. Muscovites are up in arms over plans to demolish thousands of five-story apartment buildings, the so-called Khrushchevsky. And on none of these efforts is showing any signs of letting up. This is all happening as the centenary of the 1917 revolution approaches, and such things matter in hyper-historically conscious Russia. And they are all happening as Vladimir Putin's numbers are falling and as next year's presidential elections approaches. Mark, a perfect storm, a dangerous moment.
It'd be lovely to use either of those. I think it's neither. It's a slow accumulation. These protests are individually not crucial, but they're all a bit more grit in the machine.
The truckers in the
exactly, the and also the increasing array of often very very short term industrial, you know, labor protests that we see around the country, which we don't really hear about precisely because they are wildcat and short scale. But generally speaking, there is clearly a sort of a growing willingness and capacity to protest for very, very practical reasons. And as I said, I think, you know, each of these individually is irrelevant. Each of these individually could be, if need be, bought off or crushed. The point is there are so many of them that unless the regime is willing to adopt a very, very different kind of policy, I think it's run out. I mean, in the old days, it faced relatively few and far between such protests. And therefore it could, if need be, just often it did, it would buy them off. It would marginalise them for a while and then buy them off. Now it can't because, you know, it can't give the truckers what they want. Because then, where will the poor Rotenbergs be?
I was going to say, it could.
They'll be down to their last dozen billion. You know, or, and likewise, you know, most
well,
of
the Khrushchevsky protests. I mean, I strongly suspect that I mean, I haven't looked deeply into this, but we're talking about an urban big construction project in Moscow, urban renewal. I strongly suspect some Putin cronies are getting rich off of that.
No, sure.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of expensive land involved.
Yeah,
in this.
No, yeah. This is, and so what I would say is these two things in particular, and I don't know if more fit it, but these two things definitely feed into the Navalny narrative about corruption. I mean, they really do. I mean, the Platon thing is, let's face it, it's a scam for the Rottenbergs, you know, and on the backs of long-haul truck drivers. And the Khrushchevsky thing, badly handled. I mean, very badly handled. They've been talking about demolishing those buildings since I lived in Moscow. Not in the late 90s. I mean, and so you knew it was going to happen sooner or later, and it probably makes sense, but it doesn't seem like these people are getting enough notice, enough compensation, and somebody's going to be getting very, very rich from this urban renewal project.
And it's making a lot of people who are genuinely apolitical really, really angry. You know, like I've been in Moscow for you know, a few months now, just visiting my husband, and our neighbors here, you know, people whom I don't really know, but they're all up in arms about this. I mean, and these are people who enjoy watching television and they vote for Putin and they said, oh, the annexation of Crimea was a great, wonderful thing and everybody in Ukraine is a Nazi banderite. I mean, these are people who are very like, you know, they're very much like average, like television consuming Russians. I mean, they're not necessarily like hateful, but they sort of like follow this narrative and, you know, they're comfortable with it. But all of a sudden, now that this renovation project has been announced, I really genuinely have never seen that many apolitical people in Moscow be so scared and so angry at the same time. And that to me, I mean, on one hand, I think, you know, because it's coming into people's homes, you know what I mean? Like
literally.
For a long time, the ideology in Russia is like, my dom, my крепость, like my house is my castle. And I don't care what's happening outside of my house. As long as I get to, you know, have my own little space, then I'm fine. And all of a sudden, these people are now finding out that, sorry, your space is not really your space. And you might get kicked out. And of course, this law that they're trying to pass in relation to this renovation says that you can't sue. So if you've given up your housing for renovation and you're giving an inferior apartment, you actually can't go to court. That's what the law says, which is already just bothering so many people who, once again, are not into politics at all, because this is their home. This is their private space. You know, like we always talk about, like, how Russia has devolved into this kitchen protest that people gather in their kitchens and they talk about how bad everything is, and then they just, you know, go on living as they always have. But now it's like they're taking away that kitchen from you. Right. You know what I mean? And that to me is it's indicative that, you know, I feel like this renovation project could not have come at a worse time, really. I don't know what they were thinking with their timing. I don't know. I don't even know. Like, I mean, I feel like the people in charge of the project really are not, like, they're so far removed from ordinary life. They're so privileged. They're so, you know, they have this buffer of being officials and extremely important officials that they really are not seeing what a lot of these people are feeling. Now, obviously, there are some houses in Moscow that are up for you know, up to be demolished, and a lot of the people in them are happy because these houses are genuinely just horrific. But a lot of the other housing is not, you know what I mean? So there's all this confusion about what constitutes, you know, a condemned building.
And it's not just Khrushchevkis, right?
Some of these houses, apparently, there's been some of these houses, for example, they're five-story buildings, they're post-war, but they have, you know, but they're brick buildings and they have extremely high ceilings and everything else. So they're like, they're pseudo-Khrushchevki, as they're sometimes called. And the people in them are like going, but we have a really nice house and I know my neighbors and I've renovated my apartment. I'm comfortable here. What is going on? And what is going on, of course, is that the land that they're sitting on is super expensive. Mm-hmm. That's what's going on. And, you know, Muscovites, whether political or not political, they don't trust their officials when their officials try to come into their home.
No, this is a self-inflicted wound. And another thing that it does, and you kind of alluded to this, Natalia, is that it infringes on a right, a post-Soviet right that I think is very, very cherished by Russians, and that's property.
Yeah.
You know, you touched on it with Moy Dom, Moy Krepis, but it's essentially, we're talking about property rights here. Yeah. We're talking about property rights, and this is something that, no matter how bad things get, that this is something that can't be touched, and now it's being touched. Are you coming across any, because I've been looking for this and I haven't really found it yet, but if there's any indication of who is benefiting from this, of the usual suspects? I mean, the whole truckers protest and the Platon has linked to the Rotenbergs. Is there any evidence of any Kremlin connected businessmen? Because that would be explosive if it turned out to be the case.
I haven't seen anything like that lately. I mean, what I do know, what everybody knows right now, is that, you know, Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin is a very ambitious man. He wants to leave his mark on the city. He wants to have a legacy. And this may have been started as like a big legacy project and sold to everyone else in government as, hey, you know, there are genuinely some bad buildings that need to go, you know, mm-hmm. but it's, the scope of it, of course, is unprecedented. So I feel like right now it still is a legacy project, but obviously people are going to, you know, businesses are going to start lining up to get at, you know, to be a part of this. And, you know, and it'll be important for everyone in Moscow, for everyone affected by this, to watch and see which businesses are going to, you know, it's a question of transparency. And I don't, obviously, I think they already expected to be not very transparent.
Yeah.
So.
No, I mean, I would find it truly hard to believe, legacy project or not, if somebody didn't from the get-go have their fingers in this and was standing to benefit. And I'm wondering
I'm sure it is. I'm sure. Well, the land, the real issue here is the land. It always goes back to the land, because land in Moscow is astronomically expensive. Hmm. And there's all these, I mean, the way they're planning to relocate people is that, you know, you might have a really convenient neighborhood and the metro's right there and all the stores, and then you might get shipped out to the middle of nowhere, but technically you're still within the law. You know what I mean? Because the law is kind of like, it's very poorly written right now. So yeah, I mean, it's certainly an issue to watch for anyone who cares about, you know, Moscow in general and what happens in it, and for the Muscovites themselves.
Mark, you were writing.
Yeah. Well, a thought occurred around this whole sort of, you know, question of who's going to benefit from this sort of massive redevelopment of Moscow. And it was going back to the point I made earlier about people already beginning to think about a post-Putin Russia. Sobyanin would be potentially one of the candidates for further rise. I mean, he's not an obvious one, but then again, there aren't really any obvious ones who don't have also vulnerabilities.
As obvious as anybody else.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and to do that, well, obviously it's one thing to have sort of powerful legacy projects to show that you can actually, you know, you're a builder.
Yeah.
But also, precisely, it'll give him access to a massive slush fund and be able to provide all kinds of wonderful opportunities to all kinds of people. If I was looking for a way of precisely creating a way in which actually I could build a client base of people who actually are beholden to me, then a massive redevelopment of Moscow, and particularly a sort of a sharing out of very, very high value land, wouldn't be a bad way of doing it. Now, I have no idea. I really should stress it. I have no idea if this is actually the case.
Neither do I.
But on the other hand, I think that the interesting thing is this is precisely the kind of situation that emerges when one sees a sort of the political opportunities beginning to come clear. I mean, no one really was in any position ever to think about challenging Putin. Even Medvedev, who kind of toyed with the idea during his own presidential term, backed away from that. But if you think that actually Putin's going to be going in one form or another anyway, then you might be tempted to start maneuvering. And even if you're not, then other people are going to be wondering about whether you're maneuvering. This is, I think, sort of the emerging world.
Mm. That was interesting, the way this touches a personal nerve. There, Leonid Bershitsky had a column in Bloomberg this week noting that his childhood home was slated for demolition, and he used that to kind of get into the emotional nerve that this is touching. Yeah. Shifting to the protesters and themselves, I mean, what about the tactics that are being used in these protests? Looking at the long haul truckers and the Khrushchevki protests, do you see anything new here?
Well, it's not the new thing, I think, is that there's not this big focus on Putin, actually, because as Mark is right, there's maneuvering that has begun that is so obvious. But at the same time, the protesters themselves have also gotten kind of smart, and they figure that, you know, you know, this guy's really powerful, you know, and if you come with the king, you best not miss, right? You know, as the wire taught us. So they've shifted their focus away from Putin, and they're shifting it on people who are way less sympathetic than Putin, be it Medvedev or the Rottenbergs. And they're also shifting it down to like the local level and to, you know, to try and get people who, like, once again, you know, these people who live in these buildings who watch TV and know that Putin's great. And but at the same time, they're also noticing that City Hall is trying to kind of mess with them and possibly take their housing and, and leave them stranded somewhere. You know, so the focus is not, and this is something that I think Khodorkovsky didn't get, is that the focus is not so much now on like the czar that must be toppled. It's more on like the immediate problems that people are having. And that does have, you know, a bigger emotional impact. And just to go back to something, once again, brilliant, something that Mark said, you know, you have this double-headed eagle. It may be lame, but it's got these huge talons and very powerful beaks. And of course, the question now is, in a metaphoric sense, like, you know, like, how far will these talons go? Because, like, at one point, the eagle is going to start tearing up, you know, not just its enemies. It's going to start tearing up, you know, the actual fabric of society. Like, and that's what concerns me here, is that how far is this all going to go in terms of, not just in terms of Putin himself as a leader, but in terms of this, you know, the system that he's in charge of, and the system that over the years has really resisted any kind of change and has insisted on a very top-down approach to, you know, politics, to social life, to everything else. You know, right now we're seeing it beginning to fray, but if it topples, you know, how many people potentially could it bury underneath itself? I mean, that's something we should start thinking about. Everybody should be thinking about it. I'm sure Putin is thinking about it if he's smart.
Yeah. No, I'm certain he is. Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I think one of the interesting things is, you know, going back to the protesters, I mean, they too, I think on some level, realize that the rules of the game are different and they're not quite sure what the new rules are. So you still have some doing the time-honored appeal to Putin, you know, the good czar who can who can reach in, whatever. But that's not actually getting results these days. The days when we would quite often see Putin sort of metaphorically, and I always wished it was really, parachuting in to some new locality to
give him time to berate.
Oh, I think he's moved beyond that level. You know, to berate the local governor or mayor or industrialist or whatever, spread around a little bit of cash, and all of a sudden everyone thinks, you know, thank God for the Tsar keeping the boyars in check. I think that just doesn't seem to be happening anymore. Putin cannot or will not or just is not bothering to do that anymore. But still, you get some who are still kind of looking for that way. But others are appreciating that vital thing that all kind of protesters must do is you need to build allies and constituencies. And this is, I think, still something that is very much in early days. But like, for example, if you look at some of the North Caucasus truckers' protests, they're very much framing it as Moscow against us. Mm-hmm. So I think you're beginning to start getting a regionalist and nationalist sort of dimension, which is incredibly potentially dangerous. Mm-hmm. For Moscow, if that becomes the new idiom. Now, okay, in Moscow itself, you know, they can't necessarily play that game. But instead, it's precisely, it's in Moscow, it's a question of, look, you know, we're being screwed over by the mighty and the powerful. And there's lots of other people who have similar experiences in different ways. And I think that's going to be the really interesting area to watch, is when we start seeing horizontal connections mm-hmm. becoming more evident between different types of protester.
Now, the truckers do have an ace in the hole in that they could basically grind the economy to a halt. We're talking about the country's long-haul truckers. We're talking about how stuff gets from point A to point B. And these things did not start yesterday. They've been going on for a while, and they're showing no signs of letting up. I mean, this could potentially, it doesn't have the emotional power of the Moscow protest over the five-story apartment buildings, but it has another element that's equally dangerous for the Kremlin, no?
I think it's dangerous, and I think that's why they're going to crack down on truckers after the election. That's the opinion that I've read and I think subscribe to, that they're not going to touch them before the election because these people, then once again, as I keep saying, they feel that they have less and less to lose.
Of course, if the truckers really escalate, then that means things like food not being in the shops and such like.
Yeah.
And at that point, then the Kremlin has the excuse to really slam down hard, to bring in the army to do a certain amount of emergency sort of supply shifting, and just simply to actually just start making some examples of people. There's always a very, very delicate balance. You want to be able to push as far as you can without giving the regime the excuse to deal with you. So on one level, yes, the truckers are in a powerful position, but precisely because of that power, they're also vulnerable, because exactly, they are people whom, whether it's before or whether it's after the elections, if they keep this up, in due course, the Kremlin is going to have to deal with them.
Now, these things have been going on since last year. The working assumption in the early stages was, the Kremlin's going to buy these guys off, right? And they seem to try to, but the truckers don't seem to be willing to be bought off. They want that road tax abolished, full stop, right?
Well, it's a problem of, on one hand, the Kremlin has to buy off its elites. On the other hand, it has to buy off the protesters. And, there's just simply less and less money to go around right now. And I think that's part of it.
Is part of it also that the truckers are not willing to be bought? I mean, they are willing to be bought off with one thing, ending this system.
I feel like in the beginning officials really had the chance to possibly negotiate some kind of truce. At this point now, it's gone on for a bit too long, as you said, and it doesn't seem like. You can't, if you're buying off the truckers, that means you're not buying off Rotenberg, and that's a problem too.
Right.
And also, I think this, one very specific thing about the truckers is that a lot of them do a fair amount of work off the books. And the thing about Platon is, even if in fact it's just one kopeck per kilometer or something sort of really minor, it actually creates trackable accounts for the truckers' activities. And again, it's this classic thing that, on the one hand, this is a reform that was basically meant to just funnel money into the Rotenbergs' pockets through, off the books routes, and in doing so, it infringed on the little people's capacity to do in a very, very small scale, and it's clear that at the moment the government is not willing to, as it were, turn a blind eye to the truckers' activities.
Yeah,
because they've got themselves in this position where they feel they cannot dare to not pay off the Rotenbergs, which is ridiculous in a way. I mean, what are the Rotenbergs going to do?
Right.
But
nonetheless,
nothing.
I think this speaks to Putin's ultimate policy impasse, that he's no longer willing or able to make some tough decisions that need to be done.
No, I can't help but recall a conversation I had years and years ago with a friend here in the Czech Republic when they made it a lot more difficult here for people to cheat on their income taxes. And I'll never forget the phrase he used. We all know they're corrupt, so why won't they just let us be corrupt? And that's what this is. It's Kremlin corruption infringing on little people's corruption, basically, in terms of doing work off the books.
But it's also an issue that, people, because of the way the system has evolved, people feel like they can't make a living without, going to these gray areas, into the gray economy. And that's a problem. The system has evolved to basically favor corruption on all sides. And everybody's happy with it, for a while at least, everybody's happy with it. But then that delicate balance is upset and what are you going to do about it? It does seem like there are no smart solutions on the table right now.
Now, the last thing I wanted to hit on is kind of to bring the themes all together, and I alluded to this a little bit earlier, is the Navalny factor. I mean, again, we're talking about corruption here, and we're probably talking about it in the Moscow situation as well. Do you see these things linking up? We talked about, Mark, linking this at kind of the lower level, these smaller protests over discrete issues linkage. But what about the kind of the vertical linkage with the meta themes that Navalny and, yes, Khodorkovsky are dealing with? Do you see these things kind of coalescing into a broader movement around
that is the potential. I mean, that is the game to play for. I mean, in some ways, the issue is not so much, I think, whether Navalny wants to be able to reach down and connect with all these various protests, but how comfortable they are yet
with him.
Because not so much with him, but just with the idea of, quote-unquote, making it political. There is that sense that as long as I'm just protesting against a very, very specific policy that I think has been badly thought through or isn't fair or whatever, I'm kind of political with a small p.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as actually I let this be connected with an explicitly anti-Kremlin movement, then I'm becoming sort of political with a big P, and I'm becoming part of the opposition. There's a difference between opposing the regime and being part of the opposition, and I'm not yet sure if many of these are willing to make that jump leap, yet.
And I'm surprised I haven't seen Navalny overtly kind of bring, because it's so obvious that we're dealing with it, that it seems like it would be easy pickings for him to at least use this rhetorically and to appeal to it in those slick videos he puts out. But we haven't really seen this yet. Maybe he's sensitive to the concern you raised there.
You don't want to be rebuffed.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be really dangerous.
Right. Yeah, he doesn't want to be rebuffed, and also, like, he doesn't want some of these people to get, you know, they're going to start throwing them in jail and so on. And I feel like, once again, he's a guy who plays the long game, and I think he's waiting for it to filter through naturally to the point that all of these causes are going to start aligning in a big way. And the danger with that, of course, is that Navalny does have a lot of nationalist supporters and, you know, nationalist leanings and so on and so forth. And as we discussed today, you know, this issue with the North Caucasus and them saying that, look, it's Moscow feeding off of us. The issue with Navalny, on the other hand, saying, hey, we're feeding the North Caucasus and we're giving all this money to dictators there. You know, what is going on with that? Like, these issues are going to start also coming to a head as protests in Russia continue. Like, it's inevitable. You know, this is the biggest country in the world. It has all these different republics, and a lot of these republics, you know, they don't very much like each other, or they don't like Moscow or whatever. And it's a very, you know, it's a complicated situation. And, like, I don't want to be, you know, Miss Gloom and Doom here, but this could end up somewhere really, you know, potentially, possibly violent. I mean, those are my instincts, like my animal instincts, my spider senses are telling me that is a possibility. Right
now. it's certainly something I wouldn't rule out. And I keep coming back to something Paul Goebel said on this podcast that I know you disagree with, Mark, but it's food for thought. He says that he sees the same centrifugal forces pulling on the Russian Federation now that he saw pulling on the Soviet Union in the late 80s and early 90s.
He's not necessarily, I mean, I also, like, I have to say, like, a lot of the kind of writing that Paul does, I disagree with, but I feel like those forces, they're certainly at work right now. It all depends really on what is going to be done about them. I mean, obviously, I think a lot of people learned a lot of lessons from the way the Soviet Union collapsed. But at the same time, you also have this problem that Russia, like the Russian Federation, as we know it today, the modern Russian Federation, it hasn't learned to function as a nation in some ways. Mm-hmm. It still functions as an empire.
Yeah.
And that's where the danger is, you know, because empires tend to disintegrate in really spectacular and brutal ways oftentimes. So that is something to, you know, that is something to think about, at least.
Any last enlightening thoughts before we wrap it up, Mark?
I mean, I just want to say, I think nationalism is an idiom and it's an instrument. There are reasons why it emerged in the late Soviet times that were not just simply because of a sort of a natural, organic sense of, well, we want to be our own independent country or whatever. It was also because it was mobilized by elites at a time of democratization, and precisely because the center was incredibly weak, and the center was it was weak and parasitic, which is the worst possible combination. All I would say, and I would very rarely think of myself being able to say, thank God Putin is a strong, vicious, authoritarian leader. But in this one respect, it means that at the moment there is actually very little reason for local elites to mobilize nationalism seriously. I mean, even if you look at places like Tatarstan, they've been very, very cautious. The only place where that really happens is in Chechnya. And precisely Chechnya is a case, a world, a galaxy, all of its own.
It's got its own little
agreement. I mean, I think at the moment there is still ample scope for, shall we say, political activism and for regions and republics to get much better a share without actually having to go for that kind of nightmare apocalyptic scenario. So all I would say, I mean, is it impossible? Of course not. But I think we're nowhere near that level.
No, but the fact that we're even discussing that possibility indicates that we are in a very different place than we were even a year ago, right?
I think it's a different place, and I have to say, you know, from once again from visiting Russia, from like visiting family here, for example, I'm seeing just a lot of, you know, aggression and anger sort of rising in society. I mean, you feel it everywhere you go nowadays. I mean, you've been feeling it for a while, and it used to kind of be directed at Ukraine for a few years, you know what I mean, like, screw those Ukrainians, they're the bad guys. But now I hate to quote myself, Jesus, but like a few years ago I wrote this article for The Guardian, and I said that, you know, hate is not a tame beast. You let it out of the cage, It's not going to follow your commands. And this is, I feel like this is what's really happening in Russia right now, unfortunately, on the local level, and not just in Moscow, but in other places too, is that hate is bubbling up, it's rising, and that has consequences. Mm. You know, historically speaking, that always has consequences. So maybe I'm paranoid. I hope I'm just, you know, paranoid, you know, like a super huge civil war in Russia. I don't think it's going to benefit anybody in the world, but it's a possibility. It's a possibility, and it's something, you know, we have to watch out for.
Natalia, quick question for you. I was in Moscow, obviously, in the immediate aftermath of the St. Petersburg bombing, when clearly everyone was hyper-conscious of the Central Asian factor. Now that a little bit more time has passed, I know it's still very close, I mean, what are you getting the sense of how Russians are they looking at the Central Asians at all differently?
I don't know. I feel like Central Asian migrant workers have been such a huge part of life here for so long, and especially obviously in Moscow in particular, that I haven't noticed a significant shift in people's attitudes. Obviously, you've always had the same radical groups that have hated them from day one. So, I mean, those groups now have extra reason, or as they call it, they have reason to, you know, hate the migrants more. But overall, I feel like there's such a, you know, there's such a staple of life here, and B, like, Russia has gone through so many terror attacks at this point. You know, terror attacks are like a freaking factor of life here, to an extent that I feel like, you know, for example, in the United States, we just have mass shootings, for example. Yay, we have that problem. But in Russia, like, the terror by, like, outsiders, quote unquote, is something that people are sort of, I wouldn't say they're necessarily used to it, but it's sort of, it comes up again and again, and life grinds on. Mm. But obviously, you know, but once again, change and I think policy in general, it has to factor in the irrational. You know, people respond to similar events differently because they are irrational. Like, I fully believe that. And I mean, I feel like it's very hard to be like an expert and to predict what's happening by saying that people are irrational. But I do think in general, there's just this level of hatred for everybody and mistrust in general, like the problems that you see in an atomized society, basically. And I think it's all coming to a head. I mean, I'm not going to say that something dramatic will happen tomorrow, but I'm saying the next 5 years, it will be really interesting and possibly really scary to see what happens here.
And on that happy note, we shall wrap it up for this week. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, keeping us in the Enlightenment Zone, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us on the Skype line from Moscow has been journalist and playwright Natalia Antonova, and a associate editor at Open Democracy Russia. Thank you both for the enlightening discussion.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog, and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast will take a week off next week because I will be in Tallinn attending the Leonard Mary Conference. We'll be back in 2 weeks. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.